this lecture room, I think, will be easier for me to lecture in. Sorry, it's probably a little more crowded for you, but I hope the experience will still work out for you. And hope you all are getting acquainted with the Brightspace system if you haven't used it before. And you can, you know, turn in your homework as a scan or photographs for the grader to grade. Also, by the way, the syllabus has been updated and the grader's name and office hours are now listed. So you can use that as another resource if you have difficulty with the homework. I will try to be accessible at times by email next week. So if you have homework questions, you can also try to reach me by email. And I'll do my best to answer. Okay, so today we want to continue talking really about electrostatics issues, how charges make electric fields, and some of the physics related to that. We started from experimental observation, which you can regard Coulomb's law, and showed that if you have charges in a volume and you draw some imaginary closed surface S around that volume, that the surface integral around this imaginary Gaussian surface, that E dot dA will always equal the charge enclosed inside that volume divided by epsilon naught. So I want to take this a little further today, look at the implications of this through the divergence theorem, which says integral of E dot dA, right, can be rewritten as the volume integral. This is over a closed surface S. There's a chair back there, and back there, and back there. Volume integral of the divergence of E over the volume that the surface S encloses. And this is then 1 over epsilon naught times the volume integral over V of rho of X. And now an important part of the argument is that this second equality here, this holds for any arbitrary imagined volume with a closed surface I could choose. Because it's completely arbitrary, that means the only way that can be true is if the integrands themselves are equal. And so, because the integrands are equal, we have a differential equation statement now, del dot E is rho over epsilon naught. And that is completely equivalent to this statement of Gauss's law. Okay. So basically we have Gauss's law in integral form and in differential form. Next we want to introduce the idea of the electrostatic potential that we'll be working with a lot. And to motivate that, or to get started, I want to consider a math identity, the gradient. Hi. Sorry, it's a bit crowded, but there are some chairs over on that half of the room. Gradient of this important quantity we'll be working with a lot. 1 over the distance between two points is equal, you all know how to take a gradient, but let me go through it at least once. D by dy, z hat, d by dz. I usually use this hat notation instead of what some of you might have seen as undergraduates, ijk for the unit vectors along the Cartesian axes. This operator, right, is acting on x minus x prime squared plus y minus y prime squared, z minus z prime squared to the minus 1/2. This is a sort of expression that wouldn't be that hard to work out in Mathematica, but we like to do some things by hand, the old-fashioned way. But I will say that I'm encouraging you to use Mathematica and other computational resources on your homework. Don't forget, you won't be allowed on the exams to do that. But I think there is some pretty long, grimy algebra at times in the homework for this course, which is not a lot of fun. So you might convince yourself you know how to do it. But again, to speed things up, I'm all in favor of using these tools, which are really useful tools nowadays. Okay, so, but in this case, we can go ahead and take these derivatives. For instance, the x hat derivative will be, give a minus 1/2 from the exponent. And we just do the chain rule, a factor of 2 from differentiating this guy. Then we had an x minus x prime, for instance. Right, then we'll have a y hat also with these factors, minus 1/2, 2, y minus y prime, a z hat, minus 1/2, 2, z minus z prime. And all of that will be then times this denominator. Maybe I won't rewrite it, but now raised to the 3/2 power. So a more compact way to write this, the answer of taking this gradient is simply as minus the vector x minus the vector x prime over the magnitude cubed. Which you can see, except for the minus sign, this is what we have in our formula from Coulomb's law for the electric field. So this means we can also immediately jump to another form of the electric field as minus the gradient of a function that I'll call phi of x. And let me write what phi of x is. Come over here. That'll be the volume integral over the source points that include charge everywhere in the universe. 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught in SI units. Rho of x prime over the distance. To x prime. And this is the quantity we call the electrostatic potential. So I want to go through a few comments about this. Conclusions. First, we know that for any scalar function f, its curl is always zero, right? That means that we've basically proven that the curl of E is zero in electrostatics, meaning when there's nothing changing in time, the curl of the electric field is zero. And a side note is that this integral expression for phi is not the most general possible result. I'll explain why in a minute. And basically it's because it has assumed that rho goes to zero at infinite distances. And we'll have some problems like infinite plane of charge or wire where there is actually charge going all the way off to infinity. And then some of these ideas have to be generalized. Another point about phi is that if phi of x is one solution, right, then another equally valid is for instance phi of x plus a constant. Since both of these would give the same electric field, which is what matters in classical electrodynamics. You might have to revisit that when you do quantum mechanics and think about potentials, because changing the potential by a constant actually does change the wave function. But in a rather trivial way. Fourth point is that you need both of these differential equations to fully specify the electric field in general. You need to have both. You need to use both the fact that del dot E is rho over epsilon naught, and curl of E is zero, to completely and unambiguously specify E, and by that I could clarify slightly to specify E to within the gradient of a scalar function obeying Laplace's equation. That is, to within the gradient of a scalar function f that such that del squared f is zero. Okay, so electric potential is also useful when we start talking about energy considerations, which are of course one of the most important aspects of electrodynamics. and electrostatics. So let's talk now about energy. Okay. And I'm going to try to go through this really carefully because it's sort of infinitely easy to make sign errors when you start talking about work done and energy issues and potential energy. So what I'm going to imagine is having an electric field in some region of space, and we're going to have a charge Q. Imagine a test charge so small that it doesn't change those fields. So E is created by some other charges somewhere else. And now we have a tiny test charge Q. We're going to move slowly through the electric field. And the reason I say slowly is because I want the energy considerations only to come down to potential energy and not involve the kinetic energy of the charge. Okay. So we are going to imagine that there is an electric force on the charge. And that will be, of course, F is Q times E, as we saw earlier. There are a couple of chairs over in this part of the room. Did you get the memo by email about the room change?
Yeah, I just missed my
bus. That was mean of the bus. Okay, so that's the force on Q. But remember, we wanted it to move slowly. So we have to imagine that we are going to apply a force to keep it from moving, keep it from accelerating. I'll call that F us, the force we're going to apply, which will be equal and opposite to F. That keeps this charge from accelerating. And now I'm going to calculate the work we do in grabbing this charge and moving it to some other point. And I guess I'm out of room. So the work we do, taking Q from x1 vector point in space to x2 vector point in space along a path P, will be something we can write W2 minus W1 as the line integral from the point x1 to the point x2 along path P of the force we are applying dotted into DL, which of course is the negative of the electrostatic force integral. So we can go further. This is also then equal to minus Q, the line integral to x2 of E dot dl, which we can also write in terms of the gradient of phi as plus Q, integral from x1 to x2, still along the path P of del phi dotted into the path length, right? We are kind of going along some path. We'll have some differential arc lengths along the path everywhere. But the integral of a gradient dotted into dl can be evaluated exactly. That's simply the integral from x1 to x2 of d phi, or q times phi of x2, the potential at x2 minus q times phi at x1. And this leads to the interpretation of this Q phi as the potential energy of the charge in the presence of this electric field or electric potential. And so, remember, what we expect, thinking of the signs, just kind of thinking of our how we understand potential energy, even in a gravitational field, if we do work, positive work, we are increasing the potential energy. So again, that's assuming there's no kinetic energy involved in the energy balance. Okay, so now some notes about this little derivation I just did. First of all, I think you're all familiar with this. And I realize a lot of this is just review for you. The work done is path independent. Is there a question? Right. In other words, minus q, the integral from x1 to x2, e dot dl, right. One way to show the path independence is actually this second note. Let me just go to that. By doing the integral from x1 to x1 along some closed path that comes back to itself. That means I can rewrite the integral sign with the circle on it because it's a closed loop integral now. And this is just around any loop will be zero. And you can see the path independence just from this. It only depends on the initial and the final point. And a third point about this integral vanishing. If you have a vector field, a vector function like E, and its integral is zero, then you can always use, what's it called, Stokes' theorem, I think, the curl of E dot dA. Is zero. So this is consistent with what we learned as expected, since we already showed curl of E is zero. Right, we integrate along and then we pick any surface bounded by that closed loop. And we can do that. We can add up the curl integral through that surface. Any little area element, dA vector, right, means the normal times the magnitude of the area element. You'll be doing a lot of these kind of integrals in the next few weeks. Okay, I think that's all I wanted to say about that. Now we will be calculating in various circumstances electric fields, electric potentials. Sometimes there will be conductors, or which might have charge on their surface, or we might even have insulators with charge that happens to be on their surface. And so one of the things we need to be clear about is how that affects things like the electric field or the electrostatic potential. So this is a start of an extended discussion. First, about what happens if there is a layer of surface charge on a surface. How does that affect the electric and the potential, the electric field and the potential? And then a more complicated discussion about what if, instead of a charge on the surface, what if there's a dipole layer, like a layer of polar molecules on the surface? And it gets a little tricky, and it starts to stretch my ability to do artwork. But I'm going to try. Okay, so let's look. Let's imagine we've got a surface. Let me see if I can draw a surface. And it has some charge density over it. And we're going to look at its implications of having that surface charge. It could vary across the surface, or it could be constant. Some charge per unit area spread in an infinitely thin layer. All right. So now we're going to pick a little infinitesimal surface area element on that surface. And I'm going to draw an outward normal, call it N1 hat. In fact, I haven't drawn a closed surface, so actually outward is not really defined. I'm just defining a normal in one direction, if you like. And let's say there's an electric field above this surface and below the surface. So let me just draw some, we don't know much about it yet. Let me draw, imagine that the electric field above, just above, is that. And just below, maybe, is that, E2. E1 above, E2 below. And now I want to make a Gaussian pillbox whose area is aligned with this normal. And it extends down below as well, the surface. Right, so the Gaussian pillbox will enclose all the charge that was in this original dA that I sketched here. Okay. And I guess in my notes I've also indicated an N2 hat going in the below direction, which, of course, is minus N1 hat. Okay. So Gauss, from Gauss's law, tells us something about this situation. Integral of E dot dA is going to be simply E1 dot N1 hat plus E2 dot N2 hat times the magnitude of the area, differential area element. And that has to equal the charge enclosed in the pillbox, which will be sigma dA over epsilon naught. And so what we've derived, remembering N2 hat is minus N1 hat, we've derived that E1 minus E2 dot N1 hat dotted into the direction of the first field, the unit vector, that must equal sigma over epsilon naught. So this shows that there is a discontinuity in the normal component of the electric field. And as an implication of the loop integral of E dot dl equals zero, right? This means that if I were to look at a line integral, like around this line here, going above and below, this has to be zero regardless of whether there's charge there or not. That means that E1 dotted into any vector in the plane has to equal E2 dotted into that same vector. So all the tangential or plane parallel components of the electric field are continuous, but the normal component has a discontinuity. Okay, so that's pretty straightforward to understand. Now let me do the harder one, the dipole layer. This is a case we probably aren't going to encounter in this course, but for completeness, I wanted to go through it. Actually, in AMO physics right now, polar molecules are a really big thing. A lot of groups are doing things like making Bose condensates or degenerate Fermi gases of polar molecules. So it's maybe not as academic as it used to be when Jackson wrote the textbook. Okay, so we're going to imagine a surface that has an infinitesimal dipole layer. And you could think of oriented dipole molecules if you want to have a concrete example in your head. Or I guess usually you would call these polar molecules. On a surface. But let's just mostly be thinking that we have like a plus charge density on like one side of a surface and a tiny, tiny, tiny distance on below. There's a minus sigma of x at every point on the surface. And let's give them a tiny distance of separation. S of x. Okay. Well, probably we would probably imagine that is constant, this S of x. Then one can define the dipole density, this capital D function. I think as it's written in Jackson, D of x would be sigma of x times the displacement of the positive and negative surface charges. If you really want to recast this in terms of polar molecules, one would have maybe a more concrete expression for this D of x. Let's say you have capital N of x dipoles, polar molecules per unit area. And each has a dipole moment D, let's say it's E times some displacement S. Then this dipole density in that case, surface dipole density, would be this capital N of X times the magnitude of the individual dipoles. N of x ES. Okay, so now let me try to do the hard drawing. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to convince you of the following derivation, so you might really have to go home and think about it and try to make your own diagram. Okay, so let's imagine these two surfaces with the positive and negative charge very, very close to each other. Okay, there's the one with plus sigma of x. And now here is the one with minus sigma. And here is the separation S between them. And let's see, we're going to need a normal. So let's consider a little surface area element like I did before. It, of course, has also its, in both of these very close surfaces, this is might call dA prime. It has a normal we will direct toward positive sigma side. You have to keep these directions in mind as you go through these arguments, because it's very important. And now imagine an observation point P where we want maybe to know the electric field, or in this case, we're going to focus on electric potential. Okay, and then there is this small separation vector S from the negative to the positive side here. Okay, so if you remember, this would be our position X where we want to know the potential. Okay, so here we can draw to this area element, the vector x minus x prime, will point toward P. Shouldn't have that arrow hat there. And it's meant to go right to join on to where the vector s is pointing. And this other vector to the other dipole layer, or I should say from the other dipole layer, will be x minus the vector x prime minus s. Here is the typo in your notes you might want to correct if you've printed them out. I think I had the wrong sign here in the notes. Okay, so now let's do the math implied by this diagram. And again, our concept is that there are other charges elsewhere in the universe making a potential in the vicinity of this. And we're asking, what is the effect on the potential caused by this dipole layer? So for a single layer of charge, it would have phi of x as just the integral over dq over absolute x minus x prime, which in this case, dq, I can rewrite as sigma of x prime dA prime. In this case, for the part of the potential due just to the surface, this part of the surface. And so for the dipole layer, we'll have two terms. We'll have phi of x, it's 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, the surface integral of sigma of x prime dA prime over absolute x minus x prime minus the charge from the lower layer, the negative sigma layer, minus sigma of x prime dA prime over absolute value of x minus x prime plus the displacement s between the layers. Next, we will do maybe the second rule of theoretical physics, which is when in doubt, do a binomial or Taylor expansion. And I can do that easily enough. 1 over x minus x prime plus s for s infinitesimally small will be approximately equal 1 over the distance from x to x prime. And some of you may not be familiar with multidimensional Taylor series. You might not have worked with them much in the past. But the linear term of order s in this expansion looks like s n hat dotted into the gradient of 1 over absolute x minus x prime. If that's not pretty clear to you, you might just, verify it on your own by taking the derivatives and stuff. Then there, of course, there will be correction terms of order s squared. Okay, so no one's complained about my drawing yet. Are you just being nice? Yeah, you'll probably complain about the next one, though. Okay. So phi of x, when we subtract these, okay, this term will of course, be canceled. And we'll only be left with this term involving the gradient. And so that will equal minus 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. Getting a little down in my chalk. Let's get another from my stash. integral sigma of x prime s n hat dotted into, now we know that gradient from before is n hat dotted into, x minus x prime over the magnitude cubed dA prime. And there is a minus 1 as well. We can't forget. But actually, the minus 1s cancel. And so we just have that. Now, what we showed was that this type of quantity we encountered last lecture, and we found it could be re-expressed in terms of solid angle. A differential solid angle, d omega prime. Subtended by dA prime from our observation point. There will be some solid angle. And if you remember or look back in your notes to last lecture, that relation is minus d omega prime is minus n hat dotted into x prime minus x over absolute x minus x prime cubed times the area element dA prime. It's kind of hard to visualize that. But I will stress that if x is actually above the plane, then if you go through the signs carefully, you'll see that minus d omega prime is positive. And vice versa, becomes negative if you're below the plane. So finally, a way of writing this is phi of x is minus 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught integral of the over the whole dipole layer over all solid angles d omega prime, which is the main result of this derivation. And you can, like I say, go through this on your own and maybe read the way Jackson describes it, convince yourself of all the signs along the way, which are kind of tricky. So let's do an example and look at a concrete case of having maybe a flat plane, which is where the geometry is easiest to visualize. Let's say point P, which is just above a very large dipole plane. With constant dipole density, just say d of x prime is a constant d, right? Then this phi of x from a point above the plane you're going to integrate over the solid angles on this infinite plane. d is constant, I can pull out of the integral. I'll just have d omega prime. And as I said, the minus d omega prime is positive when you're above the plane. And it's only covering half of the steradians of space, right? Because you're only integrating over all steradians below you from this point P. So this integral minus d omega prime is 2 pi, not 4 pi. Okay, so you get 2 pi times this d over 4 pi epsilon naught, or d over 2 epsilon naught is the phi above, I should say. And by the similar argument, phi below will change the sign of the solid angle. So that will be minus d over 2 epsilon naught. And so this is the main conclusion that is true not only in this problem, but also if there are charges elsewhere in the universe, making phi in this vicinity of this polar surface, it will always be true that phi just above a surface minus phi just below the same point on the surface will have a disc. There will be this difference, this discontinuity, d over epsilon naught, the difference of these two. That's the main point of this whole derivation, is to find that. So let me summarize with a couple of diagrams contrasting the case of a charge layer and a dipole layer. You guys are very quiet. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah, the dipole layer could vary in density across the surface, right? Exactly.
But we assume to compute the potential, we assume that these constants.
In this little derivation for a flat plane, yeah, but the conclusion still holds for an arbitrary surface. Yeah. Okay, so if you have like a coordinate in space, let's call it the z coordinate, that is going to go through a dipole layer. Let me sketch the kind of dipole layer with its infinitesimally spaced sides from positive and negative charge in that direction z. We're going to go through the layer, right? So whatever is our potential far away is maybe this line is far away from that surface. And then the idea is what should happen is as you come in, your potential should do something like this. Far away from the surface, it should go back to the values as if the dipole surface were not there. But, and don't forget this tiny spacing is essentially regarded as zero. It's infinitesimal in this mathematical sense. So we have this amount of discontinuity in the potential. Which we just calculated, its magnitude of that discontinuity. So potentials are discontinuous at a dipole layer. At a layer of charge, on the other hand, if you encounter a single surface with charge, there will be a derivative discontinuity, but the potential itself is continuous at the layer of charge, again in the coordinate going through the surface. That's probably pretty painful. Sorry. That's Jackson. All right. Now I think we're ready to move on to partial differential equations. And it's hard to have more fun than that. We will be solving Poisson's and Laplace's equations. Okay. So, as we have seen, a consequence of the fact in electrostatics of curl of E being zero and divergence of E equaling the charge density at any point in space divided by epsilon naught is that we can write E as the gradient, negative gradient of a quantity we call the electrostatic or electric potential. And plugging that in for E, we obtain the partial differential equation that phi obeys. Del squared phi is minus rho over epsilon naught. This is Poisson's equation. Right. It's an inhomogeneous equation. Meaning a solution would not be phi equals zero in general if rho is not zero. The charge creates the potential in a sense. That's what inhomogeneities do. They create the quantity on the left-hand side. Okay. Now a special case that we'll be studying a lot, however, is rho equals zero. That is an equation of a different nature, although it's very similar. Del squared phi is zero. There's nothing to create phi in this equation, but phi can be in existence nevertheless, even where there is no charge. You can have potential. Okay. This is called Laplace's equation, and it is a homogeneous equation, meaning one solution that's usually of no interest is phi equals zero, but we will be interested in non-trivial solutions, and we'll spend a lot of time in the coming weeks solving both of these types of equations. So we've derived this fancy-looking partial differential equation for phi, but we've already been talking about the solution to that equation as an integral. Yes, it's no longer written on the board. And it's instructive. It might seem pedantic, but it's actually instructive to go back, take our integral solution that purports to obey that equation, and verify that it obeys that equation. That ends up teaching us something in the analysis, which is maybe a little bit hard to foresee in advance. So I can view this as an important check. We're going to check whether this formula, phi of x, is the integral of rho of x prime over 4 pi epsilon naught d cubed x prime over absolute x minus x prime does this obey del squared phi is rho over epsilon naught? The answer, you won't be surprised, I hope, is yes. But the root is kind of interesting to show it. So, one thing to keep in mind is that, well, we just have to take derivatives of this, okay? Derivatives are easy to take. And we will do that. But you have to be really careful when you're taking derivatives near a singularity. So we're going to have to actually be a little bit extra careful in how we handle that singularity. Okay, so you always have to take extra caution at singularities. And we'll see this also in chapter 5 when we derive some formulas in magnetic moments, magnetic dipole moments interacting. A similar issue comes up there. Okay, so let's write our integral, or rather our evaluation, as two separate integrals. We're going to have an integral over volume V1 and a tiny volume V2 near the singularity of the following integrand, rho of x prime over 4 pi epsilon naught. Go ahead and bring del squared inside the integral for x minus x prime, d cubed x prime. Okay, so here V2 is, we can think of as a tiny sphere centered on the point x. Let's say it has radius epsilon. About the point where x prime is equal to x. And V1 is everywhere else. Outside of V2. And in V1, of course, it will simply be true that x never is equal to x prime. Or rather, I should say, x prime is never equal to our observation point x. So in V1, we'll just differentiate normally. Del squared 1 over absolute x minus x prime, distance between them, can also write as minus del dotted into the gradient that we had worked out before, x minus x prime over distance x minus x prime cubed. And let's make a variable change. Define r to be x minus x prime in our integral so that del with respect to x is equal to del with respect to r. And then basically we have to evaluate minus del with respect to r dotted into vector r over r cubed, which is a little simpler algebraically. To evaluate, this is the divergence of a scalar function times a vector function. So there will be two terms, one where there's a divergence of the vector term, and one where there's a gradient of the scalar term. Right, so this was 1 over r cubed del r dot r vector. I guess I dropped a minus sign in my notes. And then there is an r dotted into the gradient of 1 over r cubed. And I think you can quickly convince yourself that this is 3 over r cubed minus 3 times r dot r vector over r to the fifth. Maybe those signs are wrong. Yeah. Which is 0. So this will always be true, provided r is never 0, which is by assumption, because we were working in V1, it's never 0 in V1. So that proves that the volume integral over V1 of d cubed x prime rho of x prime del squared 1 over absolute x minus x prime is 0. Okay, that looks good. But we were trying to show not that it's 0, but that it's equal to rho over epsilon naught. So now we have to consider volume V1 to see how rho comes in. Next thing I need to use to show that is use the fact that V2 is a tiny, tiny, tiny sphere, which allows us to simplify the math some. Again, don't be shy about asking questions. I know I wander off into obscurity at times, and you have to, if you have a question, probably others have it also. So don't be shy. So, V2 is very small, and so within V2, rho of x prime is approximately constant. That means our integral from the V2 part of the x prime integral becomes, del squared 1 over x minus x prime d cubed x prime, right, becomes rho of x factors outside, and we're just left with the V2 integral of del prime dotted into x minus x prime over absolute x minus x prime cubed. And here I pulled a fast one on you, and I used the fact that del squared of 1 over absolute x minus x prime is equal to del prime squared of that quantity. Which should be pretty clear to you, I hope. That's why I have a del prime here now. Del prime means del with respect to the coordinate x prime, the vector x prime. Okay, so now we can rewrite this. We have a divergence. This is a volume integral of a divergence. We can use the divergence theorem. great over this surface of this tiny sphere. X minus x prime over distance cubed, dotted into the outward normal of the sphere, integrated over the surface, dA prime. That's just the divergence theorem. Here, I think a diagram will be helpful. So we can visualize all the what we are talking about. So imagine we have a coordinate origin somewhere. We have some our charge distribution in this some region of space. And we're interested in some particular point X, observation point here. And we've drawn a tiny sphere, which I'll enlarge in my drawing. And now we have our little surface area element in that formula, our dA prime in that surface area element, which we remember x prime is the vector from our origin to that point on the surface. That is x prime. And this vector from P, our observation point here at the center of our tiny sphere. Let me draw the normal to the sphere at that point, n hat prime. The vector, this little vector here, I should have made it bigger, is x minus x prime. Yeah, minus x prime. And so actually you can see from this that the distance between x and x prime here is actually the radius of this sphere. And n hat prime dotted into the vector x minus x prime is in fact simply equal to minus the distance between x and x prime. I hope you can kind of see that, how the signs work out in that dot product. Okay, so coming back to our integral, then using that fact, Now I remind you again that this integrand is this solid angle integrand that we encountered before. So I claim this is minus rho of x over 4 pi epsilon naught. And now the solid angle integral over S2 of d omega prime, the solid angle subtended from the center of the sphere out to the area element. And we're going to integrate over that whole area elements of the sphere, which will turn this integral into 4 pi and give us finally del squared phi at x is in fact minus rho of x over epsilon naught is the main conclusion, that this integral we had written earlier does obey our partial differential equation, which is at least reassuring. But moreover, we've found another useful identity that we'll use a lot. Second chalk back up. I'm just about done here. I guess I'll end with this equation. We've shown that del squared of 1 over the distance from x to x prime, which is going to come into a lot of the calculations we're doing in the coming lectures. This is minus 4 pi, a Dirac delta function, x minus x prime, right? Because we showed that no matter what is the inside the integral, we pull out the value of rho at the center of that integral. And so we can reinterpret this result as saying this. Okay, but it required us to be really careful at the singularity. Okay, so I'll see you guys, and Kaisa will lead you next week. Don't forget the homework that's due a week from Friday.